Welcome into another episode, a mid-July episode of the Scorebook Live Today podcast. It is mid-July and the high school sports in Washington are out of season, but there's still plenty to talk about. I'm Andy Bueller, reporter with Scorebook Live, here with Todd Millis, fellow reporter, and Dan Dickow over in Spokane. How you guys doing?
I'm doing great. Summer is here. It's warm over on the east side, so I can't complain too much, but you're right, there's lots of good things still to be able to talk about.
I'm hoping we can push this rain through to east of the mountains so Dan can feel our pain.
Sorry, can't help you there.
Okay.
Well, we've got, like I said, a lot to talk about today, even though it's in the heat of the off season at this point. The East-West 3A, 4A All-Star football game, it will take place at Central Washington's Tomlinson Field on Friday. We will preview that a little bit, and then at the very end of the podcast, Todd talked to the head coach of Lincoln of Seattle, a high school that has been closed down since, I believe, the 80s, and Todd talked to their football coach and really excited to listen to that interview and the forthcoming story on scorebooklive.com/Washington. But in the meantime, in the middle of that, we've got a really big project, Todd, that you've been working on the best athlete duos in the same year in the state of Washington, dating back to, I believe, your first one on this list you've compiled, which you put just a ton of work into, is 1908. So we will give our some of our favorites off that list. But first, the 3A-4A East-West All-Star Senior Football Game takes place on Friday. Have either of you guys ever been to one of these games? I understand it's kind of taken place in different parts of the state. This year it being at Central, and just talking to the Football Coaches Association folks, it sounds like they'd love to keep it at Central.
I have covered one. It's been a while. It used to be, it's sort of been a traveling circus around the state. I covered one of the games up at Everett. Oh, man, if you're going to push my memory, it was probably in the late 90s. So, but I have not covered one since. I know the game has, like I said, had gone to different parts of the state. It was in Moses Lake here the last couple of years, but I know they'd like to find a more of a permanent home, and I know they have a partnership this year with Central Washington University, and if they can keep it at Tomlinson Stadium, I think that's the preference for a really cool event in July.
Yeah, I've never been to the football event myself, but the basketball event, back when I played, graduating in 97, it was played in the Yakima Sun Dome. And they didn't necessarily break it up 3A versus 4A. It was each classification. And then what they did was they kind of made metro area teams versus state kind of teams. And so I remember it being a really fun, unique event. Because at that time, I really mostly knew guys on the west side of the state due to AAU basketball and playing against them in the summer times. But I really hadn't seen anybody from the east side of the state other than the couple teams that we played against in the state tournament.
Yeah, I was talking to over at the Bonnie Lake head football coach Jason Silbaugh earlier this morning, who's on the committee for this game and the Football Coaches Association, and I was asking him, I'm going, okay, so I'm looking at the East All-Star team roster, and I'm seeing Puyallup, I'm seeing Yelm, I'm seeing Mountain View, Peninsula, what does East versus West even mean? And he basically said that they draw a line on the south border of the border of King County and Pierce County, and essentially like the Seattle metro area is one team, and then the rest of the state pools together all the other 3A, 4A teams just because there's such an imbalance of just population density and the number of schools. So If you're thrown off by that, just looking at the rosters, that's why. I certainly was. But we'll have those rosters up very shortly. By the time this podcast releases, they'll certainly be up at scorebooklive.com/Washington. You can see if the local senior standouts on from your area team, your favorite team, will be playing in that game on Friday. But it's pretty interesting how they select those teams. I'll just walk through it a little bit. So every league has a postseason meeting, and coaches in those meetings sort of nominate players, seniors, who, you know, to basically be nominated for this game. And they each team essentially, members of this, of the Coaches Association, compile a list of about 45 kids per team. And, you know, over the weeks, it gets whittled down after the season. It gets slowly whittled down to about 30 kids. I think now the teams are about 26 and 29 kids. You know, with this year, it's a year later in the summer than it has been in past years. So, you know, that's potentially interfered for some kids with either vacation or for some of the bigger Division I players, the outgoing seniors who have since graduated are already, I mean, most of the Pac-12 schools, the freshmen are already on campus. You know, they might be enrolled in summer school or, you know, going through, you know, sort of their acclimation programs within their within the football teams at their schools. It's interesting. They don't just take the highest achieving players. You know, they look at it and they say, okay, you know, who are the highest character kids too, and first team all league selections. So, you know, it's a mix of skill and character that Silba essentially described as, you know, who do we want to send away from home in a dorm for a week? You know, the players are sending or staying at Central Washington's dorms on their campus. They're already there now. They're practicing, and the practices, you know, they're not going 2-a-days. This isn't a boot camp. This is more so, you know, reacclimating kids to, you know, who have, many of whom maybe haven't worn a helmet since the last season, reacclimating them to, you know, going through sets. And, you know, one coach, interestingly enough, described it, you know, I was kind of curious, like, what's it going to be like to coach a bunch of kids who, you know, likely have never played together and maybe haven't played, you know, contact football in a while. And one of the coaches just, one of the sentiments I heard was, you know, wow, it's pretty amazing to be able to, you know, get a coach a roster where you have a bunch of kids who are very good at what they do. And so I'm sure that's going to translate onto the field. Last year, I know it was a really close game. I think it was like a one touchdown game. There was some sort of last minute sack fumble. And interestingly enough, so I was reading a paper in Central Washington. The Daily Record had a story up on a bunch of the Central Washington commits who are playing in this game, which there are a few. And they said that basically the Central Washington Athletic Department is kind of making a push to host the Gridiron Classic, and they hope that this is that this is going to be, you know, a showcase that they can show that, you know, a game at Central Washington University at this stadium would be something that would be viable in December, as the WIAA has looming decisions to make as to where those games are going to be played.
Yeah, we can talk about, you know, down the road, we can talk about Tomlinson Stadium, the renovation. I know it's a fantastic facility now. They put a lot of money into it. We can talk about that being a potential Gridiron Classic site down the road. I do know that, you know, this, it's interesting because this, you know, back in the 90s, this is a game that used to draw the big names of Division I, Division II, Division III. I know, you know, it's hard for a football player who is selected to make a commitment to this game in January and then all of a sudden get to July and say, should I do this? Maybe plans change. So I know, you know, I know that they have to probably replace 10 or 15 guys originally from their selections in January to, you know, to the summer. So I know that's a hurdle they have to clear. But you talked about this. There's a nice blend of 1AA guys, Division II guys, Division III guys, maybe a few NAIA guys. it's not just trying to draw, you know, all the Division I All-State guys. It's you're getting a blend of a lot of different walks of life in high school football. And, you know, I know sometimes they struggle to draw the numbers that they want, but, you know, hopefully if they tie this to a particular stadium, like Tomlinson Stadium every year, that they can maybe build something, you know, a little more stable.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So be on the lookout for, if you want to check out those rosters again, scorebooklive.com/Washington. Speaking of which, there's going to be an interesting, really, really fascinating and, you know, deeply researched and reported list by you, Todd, on the site soon. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and segue into our next segment?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I you know, having been in the state and doing journalism for a long time, I'm always fascinated by the history of things and the and so kind of tying it into that wonderful 2021 class featuring Paolo Banchero at LED Basketball and JT Tuimalo from Eastside Catholic Football, both arguably the top players in the country in their respective sport. I decided to kind of go on a kind of my own adventure and trying to figure out, you know, the top different sport duos in each graduating class. And it's, I mean, there's some names. I even got Dan Dickow's name on there in 1997 Prairie. He, you know, he graduated the same year with Jawarren Hooker. I mean, I don't know if he remembers that, but it's a pretty darn good class. Just compiling, you know, this list of historical names and trying to organize them by classes, it's sort of mind-wrecking in some ways, trying to pick the top five. And Scorebook Live is going to come up with their own top five you know, different sport duos in state history. And it's been, you know, it's hard when you're looking at names like Mark Rippon from this, you know, the 80s and 70s, and, you know, Casey Kerrigan, a pole vaulter from the 60s, who's with Terry Metcalf. I mean, these are all great athletes that span our state's history in sports that were played in high schools and sports that aren't played in high schools. Like Apollo Ono, who graduated in 2000 from Decatur. He didn't play high school sports, but, you know, he's obviously a pioneer in U.S. speed skating. So, you know, coming up with the names, that's a heck of a research project. Coming up with the top five has probably been even more difficult, but I feel good about what we've done for on the boys' side, and I've got a top three girls' list that's coming out as well.
Yeah, I looked through the list of, you know, your initial research, Todd, and I was blown away by just how many good athletes that have come through the state of Washington. You know, I'll be honest, I don't know any of the names once you get back to, you know, the research you did back in the 1950s and 60s, except for a couple that, you know, everybody would know. Probably, you know, Bob Hubregs, who was, you know, University of Washington's all-time scorer, and a few guys like that. But, you know, the amount of names that are world-class athletes that have come out of the state of Washington has been very impressive.
And Todd, you have talked to both Paolo and JT, who inspired this list, being, you know, standouts in multiple sports in the state of Washington, who, you know, are incoming, you know, still have high school left. You've talked to both of them recently, haven't you?
Yeah, you know, I talked to Paolo at the Curtis Summer Tournament, just, you know, kind of a quick Q&A about where he's at the midway point of his high school career, one that's already very impressive with the accomplishments and accolades he's collected. And then I saw JT, oddly enough, at a basketball showcase, the WIBCA showcase up in Bellevue that Dan was at, and he, you know, JT showed up at kind of the last second to play. He loves basketball, but, you know, as we all know, his number one sport is going to be football. And, you know, again, it's weird. This is what sort of ties this project together. It's not, everybody asks me, what's the criteria? And obviously, it's a combination of what you accomplished in high school, what you accomplished in college, what you accomplished maybe as a pro, and then just sort of the impact in your respective sport. So, and I think these two young men in 2021, when we look back at it from 10 or 15 years from now, We might look at that particular class. And there are others in that class as well that we could be talking about as well. It just it could be one of the best in state history as well.
I look at a year like 2003. You have Adam Morrison coming out of Meade. Like you said, I mean, if you're basing this off of like what their impact was in high school, I mean, he's someone who was like almost criminally underrated out of high school and just, you know, very, very not, you know, lowly recruited and went to the local school and obviously took off after that.
Yeah. And again, you're going to look at our top five. I mean, you know, viewers and fans of the site are going to look at our site and read this and go, well, you know, there's different criteria. You're going to look at a guy like Steve Ettman. In 1988, he was not a highly recruited football player out of Cheney High School, but you look at what he did in college and being the UW's highest, you know, Heisman finisher. He won all these awards. He was the number one overall pick in the NFL draft. There are many who consider him maybe the best football player that's ever come out of the state. But, you know, it's going to be the criteria is going to be fluid. So you're just going to have to kind of let your imagination and your own eyes kind of dictate, you know, who your top five. I mean, our top five is not going to be your top five. So it should be a real talker piece. And I'm looking forward to getting that project done and people kind of giving, you know, I'm sure I'm going to hear, you know, people, they're going to give me their top fives and, you know, none of it's going to be wrong. None of it's going to be universally right. So I'm looking forward to seeing what other people think as well.
And a lot of these are, you know, personal to who you might have grown up watching or someone who you might have seen. You might have watched in person in high school, and then they went on to achieve this great success. And so you're right. It's not something. There's no, you know, one right answer to this. So in the spirit of that, Todd, this was a great idea. And we're gonna go around and each pick someone off of the list, boy or girl, who, you know, perhaps most impacted us or who we most enjoyed watching either, you know, at the high school level or thereafter. So Todd, it being your list, would you like to start?
Oh gosh, all those names are bouncing around in my head and you're asking me to pick one. And, well, I can do it. One is I'll give you one that I've covered and one that I've kind of grown up with. And the one I grew up with is a guy that, might be the best football player. There are a few people in the greater Tacoma Olympia area that consider this young man the best football player they've ever seen, and it's not just me. Mike Sellers was a fullback at North Thurston. He had to go against some of the great teams at Mount Tahoma with the Vindovich brothers, had to face all those really good Ed Fisher coached South Kitsap teams. He was a big, strong, just kick your butt, bruising type running backs, and he ended up, you know, not really going off to high to college. Had a interesting career through Canada, and then ended up playing in the NFL. I think most people remember him with the Washington Redskins when he was an H-back, fullback, tight end type. So, you know, he was one guy that I remember watching in Lincoln Bowl, going, I am so glad I don't have to tackle that guy. He was a phenomenal physical specimen. And then the guy I got to know a little bit, just being sort of the first guy from the Seattle-Tacoma market to go up and do a story on him, was Luke Ridenour at Blaine. And at that time, I was going over to the Class 2A tournament in Yakima and watching him. I was fascinated by his ball handling and the way he looked at the game. And I remember showing up at the Ridenour house in Blaine. And, you know, that, as Dan knows, that before your senior year summer is so crazy. So he had like 2 weekends to do an interview. And I remember going up there and he was sitting there with his shirt off, washing his car. I'm sure it was dirty because he hadn't had time to wash it, and just spending the day with Rob and Luke, and then getting to go out to lunch. And he kind of picked my brain from a media perspective, which was kind of cool. You know, Luke wasn't the most forthcoming guy, you know, in interviews and things like that. But he sure had a fantastic career at Blaine, and obviously going off to the University of Oregon and then playing, you know, a long period of time in the NBA, including with the Seattle Supersonics. So that was a guy that I really looked forward to seeing what his career would be like after high school. And obviously he did some pretty great things.
Those are two great, great options. Great choices. Dan, would you like to go next?
Those are two great, great options. Great choices. Dan, would you like to go next?
Yeah, I think there's a, there's quite a few years that really jump out and stand out to me. I mean, you know, myself now living in Spokane, always hear about, you know, the John Stockton and Mark Rippon battles. So, you know, granted, they were different years, 1980, 1981, 80 for Stockton, 81 for Rippon. Those kind of jumped out at me a little bit as well, because in 81, Detlef Schrempf, you know, graduated from Centralia as a kind of international transfer student from Germany. You know, but kind of more my era, my time frame, the years that stand out. 1993, you got Richie Sexson from my alma mater, Prairie, who was literally all state football, basketball, baseball. I've gotten to know him as a friend. And, you know, I asked him one time, I said, well, why did you choose baseball? And he started off by telling me why he didn't choose football. He said, well, I was a 6'8 wide receiver, and every linebacker's eyes lit up when I came through the middle, and I didn't want that target ever at the college level. I said, fair enough. I said, what about basketball? Because you're pretty darn good. He goes, well, I went to a camp down in the L.A. area during the evaluation period, and Jason Kidd and Glenn Robinson and Chris Weber and all these guys were there. And I just looked around, and he said, I realized I didn't fit in, and I wasn't going to make a penny playing basketball after college. And so he kind of, I guess, fell to baseball because he felt that that was his best opportunity to become a professional athlete. And I think he made a good choice because he was multiple-time All-Star, had a heck of a career, you know, at a number of different stops, but also in 93, you know, you look at Cam Cleland, who was a really good football player. Corey Dillon from Franklin, who was an unbelievable football player. So 93 stands out to me. 95 stands out because Brock Heward and Jason Terry, both from the Seattle area. Jason Terry being Franklin and then Brock Heward at Puyallup. I mean, those guys had really good college careers. And Jason Terry's had almost a 20-year pro career. So those 2 years in the 90s, and then in the 2000s, you know the 2000 class stands out to me as well. You know, Luke Ridenour, and then Apollo Ono. Anytime you have an Olympic medalist, I think he's won multiple golds on your list. That's pretty impressive. And then being a basketball guy, the 2002 class is just loaded. I know there's multiple sports in here. John Lester and Bellarmine Prep with baseball. Stand back from Garfield with football. But, you know, you got Nate Robinson and Brandon Roy for basketball. I mean, those are two of the best players to ever come out of the state. So those are a couple ones that really stand out to me.
See, Andy, you're asking the unfair question. Our resident basketball expert couldn't come up with just one name. So why are you doing that to us?
I'm just here to make your guys' life hard.
I know you are. And to piggyback on what Dan said, I think most of the people, and you know, not to reveal the whole list, but 2002 is going to be our number one class, and just, I mean, mainly because of what you just said, Nate Robinson. Is with my own eyes is the best high school athlete I've ever seen. And he did it in basketball. He did it in football. And at one point he held the all-time record in the high hurdles and he had no idea technically how to do it. He just did it on just will and skill, or will and athleticism. And, you know, that 2002 class, I think I always go back to, and I look at all these names on the list and I always go back to that 2002 list. I can't reduce it to two guys. I have to put Nate, Brandon, and John Lester. Look what those guys have done in their respective sports. It's incredible. And some of the other classes that are on the list that Dan mentioned too, they're just incredible. It's hard to pare it down to five. So don't crucify us too bad when the top five comes out, because you could give me a different top five and I could see arguments and reasons for those top fives to stick as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, even better, why don't you weigh in on social media? Like, let us know what you think. And you know, obviously, you guys have had personal stories of certain players on this list. And if you have those same stories, we'd love to hear them. And we'll feature them on a future podcast even. So I grew up in the YouTube generation. I remember watching Jamal Crawford crossover highlights, like, instead of doing my homework, like that, just what he was able to do. And this was, of course, you know, in his time in the NBA, So I never saw him play in high school. He graduated in 1998. I would have been 3 years old. But Jamal Crawford is one who I think has significantly has had probably the one of the biggest impacts on Washington high school basketball of any athlete. I mean, even, you know, after he graduated and his stature now in the Seattle basketball community, you know, he's still, I don't know if he's signed to a team now, but he's certainly capable of being an NBA player, you know, all these years later. But for me, you know, like you said, Todd, it comes back to 2002 and it's Brandon Roy. I mean, Brandon Roy, when he was a Portland Trailblazer, that's, you know, watching him play, what I would have done to watch him play in high school, live. I mean, he just the way that it appeared, the game came to him so naturally, and the play-by-play announcer, you know, dubbed him the natural, and how he lifted a city out of, you know, an era of basketball where they hadn't seen a winning season in years. And you know, Brandon Roy to me, that got me excited. As you know, I want to say I was in middle school when he played, and I started to read the newspaper and eventually became a sports writer. And I don't think there's a huge coincidence there. So, you know, Brandon Roy, you know, his career playing unfortunately ended early. Now he's, you know, back as the Garfield head coach and has had some successful seasons, incredibly successful seasons, coaching basketball in the state of Washington. So he probably, if I had to choose one, tops that list. Hope Solo on the girls' side. We haven't mentioned any of the girls on that list, but I mean, where to start? Like 2008, 2012 Olympic gold medalist, you know, goalie of the U.S. women's soccer team, which obviously, you know, now after she's retired has gone on to even greater heights. So she was a part of that that building process with the U.S. women's national team. But, you know, all Pac-12 selection, All-American, and, you know, dating back to high school at Richland in 1998, that she led her team to a state championship. So Hope Solo easily stands out to me on the girls' list. I don't know if you guys have any on that side that that stood out to you.
But great, first off, great job sticking to one name. That was awesome, pal.
I gave you my top, so I gave you a little separation there.
I know you did. You know, on the girls' side, you know, and I don't want to ignore the girls because, hey, you know, I put equal time and effort into compiling a girls' list. And you talk about soccer, and I don't have the actual years in front of me. I know it was in the mid-70s, but Michelle Akers, that year with her counterpart from – I mean, you look at most lists of the best soccer players, female soccer players ever come out of the state. I don't know how Michelle Akers wouldn't be at the top of your list. And she I can't remember her name. I know it's in front of you. I mean – arguably the top two players, and I don't want to slight Hope Solo on this, but arguably the top two female players to ever come out of the state graduated from the same year and they played in the same league against each other. That would be fun. That would have been a fun two matches to see. And then obviously in the postseason, there were some really good years, on the girls' side as too. I like the Erica Harris, 1982. She's arguably the best female track athlete to ever come out. She was sort of the female Daryl Robinson. Didn't really go to college though, but her 51-second 400-meter time is still a top 10 time nationally. 37 years later, it's incredible. And but again, I hope people read it. I hope people argue it. I hope we hear from people. I would love to even revisit this in a future podcast. Who knows? We might even change our minds months down the road. So it's been a lot of fun doing the research.
Yeah, and like add additional years as the state continues to produce excellent talent. So thanks for putting this together, Todd. I'm really excited to see how it goes.
Yep, no doubt, no problem.
So Todd, you since you've basically been the workhorse of this podcast this week. Earlier today, you talked to the head coach at Lincoln of Seattle, which when I was telling Dan about this before we started recording, he goes, "You mean Lincoln of Tacoma?" I'm like, no. And I thought the same exact thing. Lincoln of Seattle, What's special about that school? And talk a little bit about your conversation with him. We will play it in our next segment. So maybe just kind of give everyone a preview.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure the two of you can echo this sentiment. It's always fun doing stories that you personally learn stuff about. And I didn't know much about Lincoln of Seattle. I knew that when I was in high school, it was a school that had closed in 1981. And not to try and confuse it with the Lincoln Abes in Tacoma, I'm going to get a lot of Lincoln Abes. Then their colors are red and black. No, they're not. It's black and gold. No, there's a second Lincoln school, high school, folks. So remember, this fall there will be two Lincolns, like there are two Rogers, one in Spokane and one in Puyallup. But what I did learn was, you know, this isn't just like an ordinary high school opening for the first time. This is sort of a restart. And one of the challenges that Aaron Hart has had, not only trying to get, you know, what do you do with 30 kids in your first year and they're all sophomores and ninth graders, and they're going to play the typical JV C team schedule in their first year, which is a big formative year for their program. But one of the unique challenges that Aaron's had, and a little bit about Aaron Hart, he was a former linebacker. He's a Wyoming native and has been out in Seattle for 20 years and lives in the same Wallingford neighborhood that the new Lincoln is opening. So, but he wants to tie the very rich tradition of Lincoln of Seattle football in the 20s and 30s and 40s. He wants to tie it to 2019, and that's been hard with a school that's been closed for 39 years. So, but he's talked to some alums, and I can rip off some names. Here's a name. I'm sure Dan, you've probably faced a few of his teams on the hard court. Ed Pepple is a Lincoln of Seattle graduate, a multi sport guy. Don Coriel of the San Diego Chargers of, you know, the 80s. He's a Lincoln of Seattle grad. They've had some fantastic alumni that come through that school that just sort of vanished for 39 years. And it's Aaron really wants to tie the two back together and get some, and he wants his kids to understand that this is a school that doesn't have, you know, it's not a school, new school with no tradition. It's a school with tradition, and they should play with that kind of pride.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that school is coming back to life. I mean, you hear of all these budget cuts and schools kind of going away through different reasons, but this will definitely be an interesting story to track and to follow. So I'm excited to see how the school as well as the athletic programs kind of trend over the next couple of years.
Yeah, and jumping into, I mean, when they get to the, you know, playing, competing at the varsity level, jumping into an area that has continued to produce some of the best talent in the state. So that's going to be a challenge for them across all sports. So, you know, it certainly will be. So thanks for doing that, Todd. We're going to take a quick break, but after you'll hear a part of Todd's interview with the head coach of Lincoln of Seattle. So stay tuned.
Washington Federal is a bank based in Seattle that operates 235 branches, and it cares deeply about high school sports not only in the Seattle metro area, but across the entire state of Washington. Head to WashingtonFederal.com to learn more or visit your closest branch.
Up next, an interview with Aaron Hart, head coach of Lincoln High School of Seattle, which is opening its doors and its athletic programs for the first time since it closed in 1981. The school was a powerhouse in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and Hart hopes to revive that history, though he'll have to wait as the team will compete at the JV level until it hosts freshmen through seniors in years to come. Reporter Todd Millis talks to Hart here for a story, which is live on Scorebook Live Washington Thursday morning. This interview has been condensed for time.
Give me some of the mechanics of this. So you have, who feeds this particular school? Are you getting kids from a few city schools? And how many kids came out for football the first day of spring ball? So what are you anticipating in terms of your first year of program kids and how many teams you'll be able to field?
Yeah, so we are just sophomores and freshmen. And basically, Lincoln, it's draw area. It's kind of a convoluted boundary a little bit, but its main neighborhoods, it pulls from Queen Anne. Queen Anne used to feed into Ballard. Wallingford and Wallingford was kind of a split between Roosevelt and Ballard. And then we kind of dip a little more into Roosevelt on the north end as well. So really, it's kind of, we're really kind of taken away from Roosevelt and Ballard. And then we also get, since Lincoln, and I'll get the percentage wrong, so don't quote me on that either. We're the HCC, the highly capable cohort, I think it is. It's a lot of what the kids test into to take all the advanced courses and stuff. I want to say that the makeup of Lincoln is going to be somewhere between 30% and 50% of those kids.
Okay.
So we get a feeder from Jane Addams as well, which is kind of over by Nathan Hale. So we kind of, and we could get other kids that are out of that area as well that would go into there. So that's kind of the general makeup of it. Now, I think the overall, we're looking at about class sizes of about 400 is what Lincoln's supposed to be long-term, like, 400 freshmen, 400 sophomores, et cetera. But this first year pulling back out of Roosevelt and Ballard, I think that we're a little shy of 200 on sophomores. And so general numbers of where we're at with our football athletes right now, I think we're right today, we're sitting at about 30 athletes. And the majority of those are freshmen. I think that we have 6 to 7 sophomores and then 23 freshmen at this point. And I think that we'll get a couple more once we get into August and things like that. But, our goal, I'd love to be sitting at, 35 to 40 would be great for a year one. But I think 23 to 25 freshmen.
Now, the thing that really interested me about this story, Aaron, was unlike new schools opening and starting football, this is more of a restart for this particular school. I mean, I'm 48, so I'm not old enough to remember the 30s and 40s, but still old enough to do research. I mean, I don't know if your kids know that this is a school that had a rich football tradition back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And we're very, very competitive all the way until it closed in 1981. Do you want eventually to tie this rich history into your own program, or do you look at it as two separate entities?
No, I definitely want to. That's been a challenge in and of itself. So I've actually tried to reach out to alumni and things like that and get as much knowledge as we can. I did take a trip up to Anacortes to meet with a gentleman that had played, I think he graduated in 64, and played actually at Washington State. Just try to get as much knowledge from them as we can. I think that the challenge is towards the end when you're finding most of those alumni in the late 70s and things like that. I think that that's when they were starting to kind of get their downturn a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been kind of hard to get, a lot of what the traditions were, what, some of the things were, right? Because I think that that's important, that we do keep that together. It's a constant project, and I'm continuing to kind of reach out to folks and try to get as much knowledge about that as we can. So
who's the guy that you talked to at Anacortes, if you don't mind me asking?
His name's Scott Barton.
Scott Barton?
Yeah, Scott Martin. He was class of 64.
Okay.
Great guy. Great, great guy.
What'd you learn from him about it? I mean, having not gone to the school.
He just kind of walked through and just kind of told us about like how their practice, how they actually practiced at Lower Woodland, and that's where they jogged down to every day. And back then it was more of a friggin' dirt field rather than a real field. And that's kind of how their spring practices work, where, coaches were not involved at all, and, how the seniors and stuff kind of ran that, all of the conditioning. And then he kind of went through some of their different songs, and, we just kind of just, he just talked a lot about, just different players that were there in that era and, kind of all of that. It was really great.
Well, how difficult is it to tie, I mean, I know you've only been on the job here and doing this, and you've got other things to worry about, but in terms of trying to tie the past with the present and or future, how tough is that to do? Because the school's been closed for 38 years when you guys open up. I mean, that's a long time.
It is, and I think that it is a challenge. It's a huge challenge, right? And I'm afraid that a lot of that's going to get lost. So I mean, there's not a lot we can do yet. I mean, it's just continuing to kind of dig and see. You know, I mean, because like I'd like to get our fight song put together and what they used to do and tie that into what we're doing. But you know, so far we've not got a lot of like how they typically conducted things. You know. So, you know, I don't know. It's going to be an ongoing thing that we're going to have to work on over the next couple of years to really kind of tie in.
Mm-hmm.